The next case this morning is Whitkey against St. Clair County. Mr. Gross.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Michael Gross. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Rodney Whitkey. Under Illinois law, one of the elements of a claim for legal malpractice is the existence of actual damages resulting from, caused by the legal malpractice. The damages aren't presumed from the fact that malpractice was committed. The mere possibility of damages is not enough. That's speculative. And in a criminal case, in a legal malpractice claim arising from a criminal, the defense of a criminal case, the malpractice plaintiff is required to actually prove his innocence in the malpractice case. All of those propositions come from Griffin versus Goldenhurst, the primary case relied upon by the appellees here, also the primary case relied upon by Mr. Whitkey, and all those propositions appear in other Illinois decisions.
Does any Illinois case suggest a time different from the one described in Griffin?
No. Well, suggest yes. Say so no, because the situation hasn't arisen. The suggestion comes very clearly from Griffin itself.
Well, my question was, any case other than Griffin to which we should look, do you think, for the time at which this claim accrues?
No, Your Honor.
And Griffin, of course, has a clear statement of a rule, just that it doesn't help you.
Well, it has a clear statement of a rule, but by the time you read the entire decision, I think that the proposition is not so clear, particularly when the situation presented in this case arises, which has happened.
Let me tell you my problem. I could understand an argument for a rule that says the claim accrues at whatever time the criminal prosecution ends, whether that be the decision of the Circuit Court, the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court, pardon by the governor, dismissal by the prosecutor, that's when the claim accrues. But that's not what Griffin said. Your problem is what the court actually said.
That is my problem, but something else that the court said, there's other things the court said, I think, alleviate the problem, Your Honor. What the court said specifically about a trigger date, at least in the context, it was said in the context of Griffin's case, was that when the appellate court issued its mandate, that was the time of accrual of the legal malpractice cause of action. Griffin was not re-prosecuted. The court had no occasion to look beyond that. But in Griffin, the appellate court did cite and quote from the New York decision in Britt. It also cited with approval the Alaska decision in Shaw, and I believe it cited with approval the Arizona decision in Glaze. And in all of those decisions, in all three of those states, except that the Arizona decision is now going to be reviewed by the Arizona Supreme Court, in all of those decisions, most explicitly in Britt, those courts said that the cause of action accrues in particular when the underlying criminal case is terminated. In fact, in Griffin, the underlying criminal case was effectively terminated by the appellate court decision. Perhaps more accurately terminated when the time that the appellate court allowed for retrying Griffin had elapsed.
Isn't that exactly your problem? They did not pick the conclusion of the criminal prosecution as the time in Griffin itself.
I think it's very clearly my problem, more closely now than ever. But I think that the question before this court is not exactly what got said in Griffin, unless that's clearly dispositive of the facts in this case. The question here, I think, is what would an Illinois court do? What would the Illinois Supreme Court in particular do with this case? And from Griffin, I would suggest that this court can find that that an Illinois appellate court, the Fifth District Court, or the Illinois Supreme Court, in this case, would say there was no cause of action for legal malpractice until the underlying criminal prosecution had been terminated, and here's why. If the rule is otherwise, if Mr. Roeke was, and this is what was said in Britt, what was said in Graves, what was said in the Shaw case in Alaska, if Mr. Roeke was free to commence his legal malpractice claim and perhaps to prevail in his legal malpractice claim before the underlying criminal prosecution was terminated, you could have the unfortunate result that he would win his legal malpractice claim and ultimately be convicted, proving that he had no damages in the first place. And that takes you back to what he said in Griffin and in a number of other Illinois appellate court decisions, which is that you have to have damages for the cause of action to accrue. And the damages aren't enough if they are merely speculative, if they haven't come to fruition. And in order to have those damages in the criminal context, you have to be able to prove your innocence. Mr. Roeke could not do that conclusively because he would remain subject to conviction until the underlying criminal prosecution was terminated.
And well, he would remain subject to prosecution, but he wouldn't be convicted. There would be certainly no collateral estoppel effect of that conviction at that point.
That's correct.
He could allege all of the elements of the offense, of the cause of action.
And he could prevail in his legal malpractice claim and yet ultimately be convicted. If he could do that before the underlying criminal prosecution was actually terminated in his favor. And that creates an incongruous result, a result utterly inconsistent with the doctrine of judicial economy, among other things, of those issues being litigated twice in alternative cases in which there was no collateral estoppel effect and different results being reached. In figuring out what the Illinois...
That's a good argument that the New York rule is a preferable rule, but the question is still, did Illinois adopt it?
And what I would say to the court is that the Illinois courts, for one thing, the Griffin decision endorses Britt. It endorses Shaw.
Its quotation of Britt is studied and it stops just short of endorsing that rule. That's a very important point. The justices obviously read Britt. The Illinois justices did, and they didn't adopt it.
I didn't say that they adopted it, but I would say that they quoted enough language from Britt to make it clear that what they were saying was the termination of the underlying prosecution, which did happen in Griffin, that the termination of the underlying prosecution is necessary to avoid these untoward consequences that otherwise can occur. It's not just that it's a better rule. It's the only rule that works, and it is consistent with all of the Illinois cases that deal with those underlying issues. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. McDonald.
May it please the court, Joe McDonald, arguing for all appellees and accompanied at counsel table by Mr. Becker, representing Sinclair County, and Mr. Nestor, representing Brian Trump. From time to time in these diversity cases, the court is called upon to predict what the highest court of the state involved would do if confronted with the question before it. And this is such a case. The Illinois Supreme Court has not specifically addressed the issue we are faced with here, but it has been determined by the appellate court, two districts, in fact, the First District in Johnson versus Hallerin, and the Fifth District, actually, I guess a reconstituted Fifth District, because the Fifth District judges had recused themselves, and the Fourth District judges had filled in. And what they have determined is that, in accordance with the general rule in legal malpractice cases, a person who has been convicted of a criminal offense may not pursue a legal malpractice action against his defense counsel until he has rid himself of that conviction. None of the cases cited by my colleague for Mr. Roeke involve this situation where a criminal conviction was reversed, remanded for a new trial, and on the new trial, the defendant was acquitted. All of the cases that he depends upon, Britt and Shaw and the Oregon case, simply recited the general rule that you may not pursue a legal malpractice case as long as you have a conviction, because unlike other malpractice cases where a criminal conviction is involved, you must assert the element of actual innocence, and obviously you cannot truthfully do that if your conviction stands. That was the case in this court's...
Well, it might be truthful, it's just that there would be a judgment against you.
Yes, and that's where the element of collateral estoppel arises. You cannot, despite the fact that you may firmly believe that you are innocent,
and
assert your innocence.
Some innocent people are convicted.
There is no question about that, Your Honor. But for purposes of determining when this statute of limitations starts to run, I think Griffin Golden versus Goldenhurst has enunciated the workable and realistic rule.
Parallel to Heck against Humphrey, which said there can't be any 1983 damages action until the criminal conviction is set aside.
Yes. And I think
time starts for 1983 when the conviction is set aside and not when a re-prosecution proceeds or ends or anything like that.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
Well, isn't the rule you advocate inconsistent with the court's statement in Griffin that Illinois requires ascertainable damages for malpractice actions?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that statement simply signifies that you are not in a position to claim damages as a result of your lawyer's malpractice until you've actually suffered legal harm. And you haven't suffered that harm until it has been determined that you are able now to assert your actual innocence. And whether that comes about by reason of a reversal of remandment or by reason of a dismissal of the indictment, or by reason of the prosecution, as in Griffin, electing not to retry the case, is beside the point. The point is that you have to be in a position to assert your innocence and therefore, and thereby assert your right to damages. And you can only do that once the criminal conviction has been reversed. Counsel has argued in his reply brief that the time should be calculated on the basis of Illinois' Speedy Trial Act, namely that the state is required to try the defendant within 120 days after the mandate issues. That would not have helped Wojtki in this case, because the record indicates that the mandate was issued on May 11, 2000, and Wojtki wasn't retried until after the first of the year in 2001. Now, why did that happen? We're not sure, but we do know that under Illinois' 120-day rule, the defendant may be held accountable for the delay if he moves for a continuance or something of that sort occurs. So in that case, if we were to apply that proposed rule to Wojtki, you would have to make an exception for Wojtki and others who were not tried within the 120 days. So then you would have two rules. Now, suppose that you were tried within the 120 days and concluded with an acquittal, then you would have presumably a third rule, because the statute in that case would run from the date of acquittal rather than from the end of the 120 days. In Griffin versus Goldenhurst, the court has indicated a bright line test, and I believe that at least one of the cases that my colleague has cited endorsed the concept of having certainty, of having finality, of the court being able to determine when a statute of limitations commences to run.
Let me ask you another question. Wouldn't the rule you advocate serve to clog up the docket with placeholders? That is, many defendants who would have been dismissed if the defendant was convicted on retrial, or worse, the cases would have to be stayed on the docket waiting for all the appeals and post-conviction proceedings to terminate?
Well, you're speaking of a situation, Judge, where a suit is filed for legal malpractice
right
before there's been a determination
right
of innocence?
Right.
Well, I think the case would be dismissed in that situation because the plaintiff would be collaterally stopped from asserting his innocence. And I quite agree with my colleague that you cannot have two cases going on at one time, one a legal malpractice case against your errant defense counsel and one a post-conviction petition challenging the effectiveness of counsel in the trial. And that's all these cases are saying. We're not going to allow a convicted felon to pursue a legal malpractice case while he still stands convicted because of the distinct possibility of inconsistent results. Now, in the rare case, and I suggest that it would be rare, in the rare case where a defendant, prior to being retried, files a suit against his former defense counsel for malpractice, I suggest that the court would probably be justified in staying that case until the resolution of the criminal case, obviously, to present the same kind of problem.
And wouldn't that result in a lot of stays, though? Possible stays, given the number of malpractice claims that are filed?
Your Honor, that is possible, but I really don't think it's realistic to think so. And that is because I haven't found a single case, other than Wakey, and maybe my colleague can correct me, where there was a retrial, and the defendant was found not guilty, and then filed suit. I haven't found a case. I suspect that this is not a big part of the malpractice docket, that is, convicted criminals suing their defense counsel either before or after their conviction is reversed. But I think the important thing here is that this court is not being asked to chart new territory or to plow new ground. The court's only function here is one of ascertaining, if possible, what the Illinois courts would do with this question, and whether this court agrees with it or not is really not the material. And the fact of the matter is that the courts have clearly spoken in Illinois that the cause of action for legal malpractice against criminal defense counsel accrues when the case is terminated, Johnson, or when the mandate is issued, Griffin versus Golden Hush.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Prentice?
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the notion of clogging the docket, if the rule appears in the district court decision in the context of this case becomes the law, that is the law, then, as I understand that rule, every criminal defendant whose conviction is reversed on direct appeal, vacated in post-conviction proceedings, immediately has a claim for legal malpractice against his attorney, because he's been proved innocent. He's innocent now. And he can prove the element of damages, even if he's subsequently convicted. That is exactly what is wrong with that rule. And it is not a rule, as I've already argued, that the Illinois courts would adopt in this case if Griffin and Lucy and the other Illinois decisions are guides. As far as having a bright line test, the test that I am proposing with the court in Britt, the Arizona court in Glaze, the Latin court in Shaw established is a bright line test. And the bright line is when the criminal prosecution terminates, which generally would be an identifiable time. In this case, if nothing else had happened, it would have been after 120 days from the issuance of the appellate court's mandate. But that's just one way that the criminal prosecution might terminate. If nothing else happened. That's a bright line test. And then, again, with respect to ascertainable damages, until the underlying criminal prosecution is terminated, the plaintiff in the legal malpractice case simply can't prove that he has damages, because he can otherwise not preclude the occurrence of reconviction. And that's what was done wrong to him.
Well, let me ask you this, too. If we find that the cause of action accrued when the mandate issued, should the statute of limitations be told during the time in which he's still in custody and before he's acquitted?
I think the rule that what the Illinois courts would do, that would be one workable solution. It's not what the Griffin decision and the Lucy decision suggest Illinois courts would do. And it's not what the other state decisions that were approved in Griffin, at least to some extent in principle, including Britt Glaze and Shaw, that's not what they did. And there's no basis for believing, except for the particular statement made in Griffin, that's what an Illinois court would do in this case. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.